Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Sorry it's been so long, folks. What with the holidays and also a nice little illness, it knocked me out for half of the month. So my apologies, and promise that December will be much more plentiful as far as episodes goes. So to crack things off, we're going to wrap up the Loeb Report. This is part three. Jeff no longer is with Heroes. I'm sure you all are aware of that. This was recorded before he was let go, so you will still hear references to Heroes, along with his current books like Ultimatum and Hulk, which is enjoying its second story arc. So we'll be talking about those books and answering questions from the Jinx World message board that Jeff was kind enough to answer. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by Witchblade, the anime series, available now on DVD and digital download. Based on the comic book series from Tom Cow Productions, this anime series goes into the future to tell the tale of a new bearer of the Witchblade and the conspiracy that surrounds her burden. The 24-episode series box set features wraparound box art by Mark Silvestri. It also includes 100 minutes of extra features, including all you want to know about Top Cow, with interviews and a very cool tour provided by Mark Silvestri himself. Very interesting bonus features on the Witchblade box series. Witchblade is also available as a digital download, available at iTunes, PS3, PlayStation Store, Xbox, and Amazon. And if you'd like to view clips from the series and box art, just go to visit the website, Funimation.com/Witchblade. Witchblade, the anime series from Funimation Entertainment.
It's time for part three of the Loeb Report. It's John Suntress here from Word Balloon, and we're back at Stately Loeb Manor to wrap things up with the final few questions that we got at the Jinx World message board in the Word Balloon thread for Jeff. And Jeff is back. How's it going, man?
It's going well. You may hear some banging. I'm putting a guest house, attaching it to the pool house, so that when I actually go outside and swim in the underwater grotto, I can actually come up inside of the pool house and then stay in the guest house all night long.
Outstanding.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty great.
You
know,
go,
I
man.
Mean, when you're doing the Red Hulk, that's the kind of success that you find yourself with. I don't know what that means.
No,
I'm lucky to be able to get peanut butter.
Any good Hollywood stories from our last conversation? We left you off to Allie Leiter's engagement party.
And it was pretty spectacular. You know, she and Hayes, who's her fiance, who's amazing, took over the the terrace at the Sunset Towers, which is quite the la-di-da.
Wow! Yeah,
and she, had about 100 people and hors d'oeuvres and champagne, and a good time was had by all.
Excellent. All right, man. We're in the home stretch. We're down to our last third of listener questions, or our last quarter of listener questions.
That should only take us another 9 hours.
Exactly.
Looking forward to it.
Leaf Insect Man.
Hello, Leaf Insect Man.
He wanted to know first, did we annoy you with all your commando questions?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Yeah, you seem pretty well. Man, we got the history of Boof. The whole shot, man.
Yeah, I wasn't aware that Boof was in commando, but that's a good story.
Heroes-related question. Sorry if this has been asked before. How far into the future have you guys mapped out Heroes? Or rather, how many seasons worth of stories do you guys have?
Well, I thought, because we do time traveling on the show, he was wondering whether or not we actually go into the future. That's kind of a question that I would probably throw to those esteemed young writers, John Dukaski and Aaron Collite. If they were on right now, but they're
right.
Not.
No, they're not.
And, you know, maybe to Jesse Alexander, but not so much.
Okay.
I think I've now done that joke once. Okay, let's see how many times more I can do it.
Well, everyone's had their first drink, so that's good.
We have a pretty good idea as to where the series ends, if it were to end once upon a time. It keeps getting moved out year after year. But for the most part, right now we're in season three. We've talked about four and five. The ideas to, just come up with sort of the big tent poles. It's like, for example, this season is broken into two volumes.
Mm-hmm.
The first is villains and the second is fugitives. So, just knowing what they're going to be called means that we have a pretty good idea as to what's going to happen in the larger picture and where the characters begin and where the characters end. The journey is always the interesting part.
Absolutely. And also something that I've talked to you about and Jesse before, the things you've learned from Lost and other shows like, and Alias even, going back to, Jesse's and J.J. Abrams' earlier experiences of how much to reveal and the pacing of when to reveal clues and you know, without pissing everybody off and saying, you know, what are we going to learn? Or, you know, are, you know, as a board.
It's a very fine line between keeping the suspense going and actually giving it up. But, you know, look, it's not all that different from comics. You know, when is the appropriate time to reveal the Red Hulk's origin? And, you know, people thought it was issue 6, and it just felt like we could go longer.
Okay.
And some people, you know, throw their hands up in the air and say, I don't want to do this anymore. And some people, you know, hopefully the mysteries are the things that kind of tickle you, but unless you're completely involved with the character and with the sort of the bigger story, then you really don't have anything. You know, Lost, for all of its frustrations that people have, it still comes down to the fact that it's a pretty damn good show about a bunch of people that are stuck on an island. And, you know, you're invested in Jack and Kate and Locke. I don't know how invested you are in what the Dharma experience turns out to be. And if that's what you're invested in, ultimately you're going to be disappointed, because it's just, it's like any murder mystery.
It's a MacGuffin.
At the end of the day, you know, whatever answer you come up with, it's not as good as what happens to the characters themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the answer of what the Maltese Falcon turns out to be is nothing compared to what happens to Sam Spade.
Sure. No, I agree with that. Yeah, I'm with you. And that's, right, that's the MacGuffin, as Hitchcock used to identify it.
Well, sometimes it's the plot. I mean,
Well, yeah.
I mean, when you come down to it, you know, in Long Halloween, who is Holiday, and Hush, who is Hush, were things that, you know, you were trying to find out. It was much more than the MacGuffin. The MacGuffin would have been, a clue trail. The MacGuffin in Dark Victory was the hangman letters that were being left by.
Okay.
But when you get to the end of the story, and, you know, if it turns out to be, you know, the Muffin Man, you know, some people are going to like that it's Muffin Man, and some people aren't going to like the Muffin Man. You know, I was particularly delighted, to pick a word, I think I got asked last time whether or not I'm delighted
yes.
when I'm writing something. You know, I always knew that it was Ultron who killed the Scarlet Witch in the Ultimates, but it really wasn't until I was writing it that I realized that, you know, the Ultrons were created by Hank Pym in order to replace the super soldiers. That the idea at the end of the day, as he said in Volume 2, that Captain America at the end of the day was still a man, and so he could be killed, whereas that they were robots, and who cared?
Sure.
And Fury turned them down, and so they were turned into domestic help. They replaced Jarvis.
Yeah.
And so I got to, like, do the line that, you know, I think every writer tries to write whenever they're in a mystery, which is the Butler did it.
Absolutely.
But unless you're invested in who the Scarlet Witch is, what Pietro was going through, and then ultimately what happens with Magneto, then who cares whether or not Ultron killed the Scarlet Witch?
Mm-hmm.
In the same matter, you know, hopefully you care about the fact that this, you know, metallic organism had come to have feelings for this woman and realized that he was never going to have her, and so he killed her. You know, I mean, if you get involved with that part of it, then you've done your job. But if all you're doing is trying to figure out clues, then you're not really getting anywhere.
All right. Leaf also says, by the way, that Danya Ramirez is hot. And,
yeah, she sure is.
And Mr. Loeb was trying to explain that to us last season, and it has been now confirmed that she's stopped crying the river of tar tears and is cleaned up.
Yeah.
and not on the run like she was in season 2.
No. She is firmly tied into the story with Suresh this season.
Alex Maine, are there points where you find the criticism too much to handle?
Which criticism?
That's all he says. I'm assuming stuff. We've discussed this in part two, Alex, as far as online criticism, I'm guessing.
To answer your question, it's never nice to have somebody not say nice things about you. But first of all, I don't encounter it enough. I do believe in stay off the net. So if that's why I'm sure people realize that when that stuff's written, I don't respond. And a large part of that is I just don't know it's there.
Okay.
And so, you know, my job at the end of the day is to produce a television show that people are watching and to produce comic books that people are reading. And so what I did was I listened to critics, both good and bad. I'm not doing my job. And I'm just trying to tell stories.
Very cool.
Does it bother me when someone, you know, talks about me as though I came to their house and shot their dog? Yeah. I mean, who wants to have that said about you? But there isn't anything I can do about it. And one of the things that I have learned, and I think, you know, Bendis and Miller and or Millar and Jeff Johns will all attest is, you know, when we were all making books that were selling 30, 40,000 copies, we were the dreamboats of dreamboats. It's when you start, you know, being there at the top tier, you know, when you're selling 10 times what you were selling back when you were a genius, you've got 10 times more the number of people that can say they hate your stuff. And that's generally what happens. You know, it was a real eye-opener for Jeff when he moved up to, and when I say up, you know, just in terms of the exposure that he was getting on Infinite Crisis from books like The Flash and JSA. I mean, he just had never felt the backlash of it all. And it really didn't come down to the quality of his work at all. It just came down to, you know, if 30 people are reading your book, it's different than if 100 people are reading your book.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's just, you know, the dog pile of it is fun. You know, when somebody decides this stinks, then it's just more interesting to keep saying it stinks.
I'm with you. Scott HPDX, are you a fan of Ed Brubaker's current run on Captain America? I believe you are. And has it any had any influence on your Captain America White story?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I respect what Ed's doing, despite the fact he's an anti-Semite. I kid. I actually did talk to Ed after that. You know how nervous I am. I made a joke, and I called him and I wrote him, and we both decided that, you know, the truth of the matter is that Fraction's the anti-Semite, so that was why it was funny.
There you go.
Matt Fraction. You know, what I love is that Fraction is because the writer can do no wrong. So we're going to watch, you know, him rock to the top, and in about 2 years, somebody will write to him and say, "So, Matt, how do you like the criticism?"
Matt, how could you ruin The Angel or
exactly.
Something? Yeah, I know.
Or better, which is, you know, the first thing about Iron Man. I've only been writing the book for whatever.
Great first start.
So Ed is, Ed's kicking ass on Cap, and I'm just trying to stay out of his way. And, you know, I think that's the most important thing. I don't want to come up with something that's different. You know, he and I both agree that Bucky's relationship with Cap was not Batman and Robin.
Okay.
Bucky was never that young. And so you're talking about somebody who was 16, 17 years old. Well, if you do the math, then, you know, Steve couldn't have been much more than 22 years old because he was enlisting.
Right.
So it wasn't as though he'd had some other job and hung around until he was 30. You know, an argument could be made that he was 18, 19 years old when he tried to enlist.
And do you think Robin, conversely, was like 8 or 10 or, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, every time I've written him, he's 10 or 12 years old.
Okay.
And Bruce was 25. And there's
right.
No two ways about it. Bruce was somewhere in his mid-20s or even later than that. So it definitely was a father-son relationship, and that's what Robin was looking for, and that's what Bruce was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, and it's something that I really spent a lot of time on in Cap White, is that, you know, Steve saw in Bucky this kid who wanted to go to war, and it wasn't that long ago. And when I say it wasn't that long ago, again, Steve was at basic training when he got called up.
Mm-hmm.
So he had met Bucky within months of when he had become Captain America.
Yes.
So the idea that he was this string bean who couldn't go to war had to have been fresh in his mind when he met this kid, this teenager, who said he wanted to go to war. So I remember at the very beginning when Ed said that they were more like brothers, that a lot of people got all upset. But I think he only meant that they were, you know, it's like the older brother in the family and the youngest brother in the family.
Sure.
But I completely subscribe to the idea that they couldn't be more than 5 years apart. And that has changed the dynamic of their relationship for what I'm writing, and both Ed and I agreed that that seemed about right.
Very cool. Since you like color so much, what is your favorite color? And have you used it on a title, or do you plan to?
Thanks for playing our game.
I'm thinking of this great, like, 64 Crayola, you know, Umbra.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Teal.
Yeah, I don't even know who. Aqualad Teal. I don't even know who would
be. There you go.
All right. Jimmy F. 1982. After reading Hulk and Ultimates, I have a few more questions. However, I previously asked the three in the thread, so if you'd prefer to skip these, I understand. Now that Ultimates,
very polite, Hangman.
Well, you know, that's all right. Now that Ultimates 3 is finished, and it's already been announced that Miller is coming back to do the Ultimate Universe for Ultimate Avengers, has Ultimates 4 been canceled? And I will. And if so, can you share what you had planned to do for that arc, or is that arc what Ultimate made him turned into?
No, it's not what Ultimate him turned into, and some version of the Ultimates will continue. Mark's version of Ultimate Avengers is not what people think it is.
Okay.
So that's all I can really say about it. Mark is not doing the Ultimates, that much I can tell you.
Ah, okay. On a previous Word Balloon, you stated that you built storylines around a single idea. For example, you talked about wanting to see Wolverine and Sabretooth fight on a plane, and the Evolution storyline was born. And with that...
I don't believe that's what I said, but that's awesome.
I think what
I had said was that I thought it was time for Sabretooth to die, and so that would have been the storyline. Do I build a single issue around a moment that would give me something cool? Yeah, I mean, that part I'll give you.
That
Sabretooth and Wolverine fighting on a plane and a plane going down was certainly something that I could use as, okay, that's my centerpiece, let's build out from there. So if that was somehow mistaken, I'm sorry, Johnny on the spot, whatever your name is.
Jimmy F. 1982.
Yeah.
Well, then he asks, and I think you'd already answered this to a degree, with that in mind, did you read Wanda talking to Ultron in Miller's Ultimates 2 and think, holy shit, I got the greatest idea for Ultimates 3?
Yes and no. I mean, I think if you go all the way back to when Wanda fell in love with in the Marvel U,
right,
with the Vision, and the Pietro hated that what was going on. I mean, I actually have that piece of artwork from Avengers 93, Neil Adams drawing,
wow,
Ray Thomas on script, which is the first moment where Wanda, they're about to go over a fence, and the Vision says, let me give you a hand, and Pietro cuts in and says, my sister doesn't need to have anything to do with you at all. And that's, for me, where it all began. And so when Mark wrote, Wanda, were you flirting with that machine? I could see that there was an opportunity there to dig in that the butler did it.
Sure. So the Red Hulk is Maria Hill, right?
Absolutely.
And he says, thanks for calling.
On what universe? I'm not exactly sure.
All right. R.W. Smith.
R.W. How are you, pal?
Did Joe Matt intentionally draw some of the characters in the Ultimates more like their 616 counterparts? For example, Wasp not being Asian, Wolverine being short when he's around 6 feet tall in the Ultimate U. I have the tape measure. That's me saying that. Magneto in his 616 costume, etc. Or was this something that was missed by the editors?
I don't think it was missed by the editors. There were certainly choices that we made. I think if you go back and you look at the Wasp, it's just a choice as to how, quote, Asian she looks. We never said she wasn't Asian. You know, people have different interpretations as to how people are drawn. What was the other one that he was concerned about?
Wolverine being short when he's around 6 feet tall in the Ultimate Universe.
Okay, well, then people around him were taller.
Okay, and Magneto...
Or he was standing in a box at the time. I don't know.
And Magneto, he's got, like, big platform shoes like Huggy Bear. Magneto in his 616 costume?
I've seen Magneto in lots of different outfits, so I don't know how that sort of comes around to anything. Like to me, it if we had drawn Nick Fury as a white guy, then I could see people going, "Hey, what's going on here?"
Yeah, that happened actually early in the Ultimate Universe, as you remember.
I didn't have anything to do with that.
Oh no, I understand, but I was saying that was, you know, I remember people like telling Millar and Bendis that and saying, "Hey, what the hell?" Now he's suddenly Samuel L. What's going on?
Yeah, true. I thought what Joe did was brilliant, and it was great having him back in comics. And when that trade is all put together, I think it'll be around for a million years. So I love what he did.
Now, is this right? Can you give us any hints as to what your upcoming Ultimates Volume 4 with Frank Cho will have in store for readers?
It's kind of right. It certainly is. It's not a surprise. I mean, I did announce that we were going to do an Ultimates project.
Okay.
I think it was originally called Ultimates 4. It involves... Frank is doing the artwork, and I can't really talk about it because I don't know who's going to survive out of Ultimatum.
Fair enough.
In order to see whether or not there will be an Ultimates, and if so, what does that mean?
Okay, and then he also wants some hints on Ultimatum, which we have gone over in previous parts, particularly involving Wolverine, who apparently is the source of all mutants in the Ultimate U as per Ultimate Origins. And I'm sure you'll be expanding on anything if that has to do with it in Ultimatum.
That would be correct.
There you go. Oh, it's Mr. Loeb would like to say. I'll be your lawyer. Mr. Loeb is advising.
We have no further questions for this witness.
Step down, R.W. Smith. Yeah. Here's the goddamn Schweitz.
Ah, I love when he asks questions.
Me too. Gives me the chance to break into my Mel Brooks.
Absolutely.
If you have a book delayed because of an artist, do you get upset or worried about the reaction it will get when it comes out because the pacing will be off? Or do you just think, hey, 5 years from now, no one's really going to remember this got delayed a month or however long?
A little bit of both. I mean, I'm not actually concerned about the pacing of it as much as, you know, I think we all care that, you know, when you go on your Wednesday to the comic book shop, you'd like to have the book there.
But yeah.
I do believe that you are better served by having the original team on that book. And I think that had there been a fill-in artist on the... what do you need? Yeah, absolutely. Sorry.
No problem.
I think had there been a fill-in artist in any of that stuff, you know, let's keep in mind, you know, Mark and Brian did 25 issues over a five-year period.
Yep.
And so... You know, once that becomes the rule, then, you know, there's a big part of me that goes, I really don't want to hear about it.
Sure.
Because the reason why people get upset is because they care. If you didn't care, you'd go, you know, so what? You know, I mean, I don't know whether or not. Do they still publish Nightwing? Sorry. You know, I always go for a Nightwing joke.
Yeah.
Yes,
you do.
No,
I just
you know, but honestly, there's comics out there that, you know, I don't know that anybody follows, and they don't know whether or not something comes out or they don't come out. But if you're, you know, if you're a Connor Hawk fan and there's a Green Arrow 6-part miniseries and part 4 doesn't come out, I don't think it's going to shake anybody who's out there other than people that are reading that book. Whereas, you know, if you do something like Ultimates and, you know, you put out 5 issues a year and people are expecting 12, you know, you get a lot of raggy.
Sure. What did you...
But I do think that when the book is all collected in a trade, then nobody cares. I mean, honestly, nobody remembers
how
late the Dark Knight was. Just nobody remembers.
Did you hear the... Well, it was kind of a subtle announcement this week because they just listed the January releases, and I guess on the other side of the street for DC, Final Crisis 7 is not being drawn by J.G. Jones. It's being drawn by Doug Mankey. Now, Doug is also drawing the Superman tie-in to Final Crisis, and apparently threads of that story are going to play big in the final episode, but I know there have been comments online that, oh, saying the same thing you did just now, saying, you know, oh, I wish it was the same art team all the way through.
I think that ultimately hurts the book. I do not believe that when you're doing a storyline that to abandon the artist along the way, which, by the way, for most of comic book history, it was perfectly the norm to do.
Sure.
And that you'd have fill-in guys all the time. You know, I look at my mostly DC trades,
mm-hmm.
and I'll be cruising along in a story and suddenly bump into a guy that I actually forgot I'd worked with, and it's completely disruptive.
Okay.
Now, to the guy, average guy, I'm not sure that anybody notices, and I'm sure that's what the powers that be stop and look at it. But I think that people out there are now sophisticated enough that, you know, had issue 7 of Hush been drawn by Scott McDaniel, who
mm-hmm.
I respect,
mm-hmm.
I think people would get that trade and look at it and go, what the hell happened here? I'm reading along, and all of a sudden, it's like a different actor is playing this part. And I've said that often, which is, you know, if you were at a movie and you were watching Tom Hanks, and the movie's 2 hours long, and an hour and 20 minutes into the movie, suddenly Tom Cruise is in the movie, who's a perfectly capable guy, and he's in it for 10 minutes, and then Tom Hanks comes back and finishes the rest of the movie, I think you'd come out of the movie going, what the hell just happened?
Almost, unless it's, what was that David Lynch movie, Lost Highway? Where Bill Pullman and I forget the young actor, basically are kind of the same character, but, you know, it was a big twist.
Is whack.
Yeah, I
know,
exactly.
For me.
Well, there you go. You know, I'm sure.
No, look, in the same kind of way, I'm sure somebody decided that, you know, if Doug Mankey was doing the Blah, then that could be the Blah. But, you know, there are guys, JG is one of them, who I think is brilliant, but honestly, if you're going to sit down and say to yourself, this guy's going to put out 7 consecutive issues, on what planet do you live? That's not a slam against JG.
I mean,
look at the guys that I work with.
Oh, this, yeah.
You know, it's just like, when we sat down and said, Ed's going to do the Hulk, I said, great. Everybody understands that after 6 issues, we're taking a break. And they were all standing around going, what are you talking about? I said, well, it's not going to draw 12 in a row. And as long as everybody understands that, this is how we can make it work. And it's, we used it to our strength again in Superman and Batman. Because by doing those arcs, I could be writing issue 5 for Ed, issue 8 for Turner, and issue 17 for Carlos.
Mm-hmm.
If those guys are available, that's the other problem. And so, you know, when you're working with that top tier, you always run the risk that somebody's going to be late. And I'm not happy about it. I think anybody's happy about it. But I think at the end of the day, the reader would be happier if the book looked the way it's supposed to do. I would rather read Thor with Olivier Coppola doing the artwork than Johnny on the spot coming in and doing the artwork.
Sure.
It's just the way I am.
I understand.
So I don't want to open that book and go, what's going on here? And I remember that just as a kid going to the store and opening it up and looking at it going, this doesn't look right.
There was more concern about getting the monthly product out every month. I mean,
absolutely.
That was, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that either. And I can appreciate from an aesthetic people complaining, but I also can understand if, you know, 7 other books have to launch. I mean, the problem that happened with Infinite Crisis and 52 starting when it had to start, and them kind of putting themselves in the box of, okay, we need the last issue to come out, you know, whether George and Phil can make it to issue 7 or not. And, you know, unfortunately, that last book, as you say, I mean, it did look different. People were disappointed. Some people were happy that the story was still, you know, it's, I can see both camps. I honestly can on something like that. There's my 2 cents.
I would rather, you know, see whether or not you can move the floor around and try to make it work with what you have. And if that means that, you know, some stuff gets delayed, stuff gets delayed. I mean, I think you have to really look at these big events and try to decide whether or not it's going to be possible.
Sure. Back in the day, during the Bronze Age and the Silver Age, you had a guy like Murphy. No, I mean, not that I'm that old. Back then,
but
no, I was going to ask, and I'm assuming as an observer and a reader back then, you'd probably say the same thing. They had guys like Murphy Anderson, like, hey, this guy's late. Can you finish this for us? And was the guy was such a fast and amazing artist, would do it, and kind of, you know, I'm sure you saw some Murphy Anderson in there, but it was kind of that seamless house style that allowed for, I think, that to happen more unnoticed at, like, say, a DC than a Marvel.
Yeah, I completely agree. But, you know, you'd be tooling around with Gene Colan, and suddenly Don Hack would walk in.
Absolutely.
You'd be like, well, I don't even understand.
Hell, even Gene would sometimes, like, step in, and you'd be like, wait a minute. Like, I remember that with Captain America, like, right after Storenko. Boom, there's all of a sudden, there's Gene Colan, and it's like, really? Well, I didn't know the story was done.
Well, you know, I told you that story when I talked to Steranko once and told him that his Captain America run was, you know, seminal for me and Tim. And he said, run? Really? I couldn't even put three issues out in a row. But, you know, those three issues, when you put them together, are pretty fantastic.
Oh, it's awesome.
And, you know, I don't, you know, I went back and I read the Kree-Skrull War, and I'd actually forgotten that Neil didn't draw all of it.
There you go.
That John Buscema and Sal Buscema were both, you know, lobbed in there. Both really top-notch guys, but boy, when you get to the Neil Adams issue, one, which is really funny because the story sort of veers off into the Inhumans. You know, it's like an 8-part story, and suddenly, like at part 5, it suddenly becomes the Inhumans. And there's Neil, like in all his glory. And clearly, what they did was, you know, rather than saying, "Why don't you draw the last two issues?" They said to him, you know, the next one you could probably do was 5. And that's, you know, that's something I would have thought about. But, you know, again, those books came out on a monthly basis.
Absolutely. He also says, by the way, that he's really loved your work recently and looking forward to seeing what you have coming down the line.
That's very sweet. Thank you.
Sean DePasquale.
Hi, I'm Pasquale. How are you, sir?
I have some writing questions.
Okay.
Between Lost, Smallville, and Heroes, which writer rooms have been the most creatively charged? Which is the most passionate about the shows they're working on?
I don't think there's any difference. I mean, I think one of the pleasures about working on the shows is that everyone was passionate about working on them, and they wanted to do what was best for the show. The differences were in how the writers' rooms themselves were conducted. You know, in the case of Smallville, very early on, Alan Miles would let the room run itself and then would come in towards the end of it. In the case of Lost, Damon Lindelof was extremely involved. And so any forward momentum largely was helped by Damon being there. And there's sort of a mix with Tim on the writer's room at Heroes, in that, you know, you've got guys that are as quick and as smart as Joe Pekaski and Aaron Collide are, who are the two young brightest writers that are out there. And they also write comics too. I don't know that you know that.
Heard
Joe
about that.
Joe does Secret Invasion, The Inhumans, and is also taking over the Ultimate Fantastic Four for the end of that run. And Aaron Collide, as we know, is doing a superb job over at the Ultimate X-Men. And you never know, you know, some new bright young guy like, say, Harrison Wilcox, who works with me, could just pop on the scene at any time. Jesse Alexander, not so much.
There you go.
But, you know, when we're in the room, we just try to move the thing, you know, like gangbusters, and Tim just has a really, really good sense as to what works on the show, and so it's very, very much a collaborative effort.
Cool. Has Mr. Verheiden begun his work?
Mr. Verheiden has joined us.
Okay.
And in fact, his first episode is 4. Well, it's 3:15. I keep calling it 4:15. It is the second episode after the beginning of Fugitives.
Okay.
So he really gets the kickoff.
Very cool. Now, you've mentioned this in a previous interview, so I'll let you decide whether you'd want to talk more about it or not. Well, it wasn't...
Okay. First of all, I didn't know I was in Cuba at the time. Second of all, the guns were not mine.
Mr. Loeb would like to avoid this question if possible.
Exactly.
Could you tell us about some of your contributions to Lost during your time there? And I know we've discussed this before.
Yeah, but... I think we've talked about that.
Okay.
I had a great time, and it's a superb writing staff, as everybody knows, from the quality of the show. As I often say, I have not met a lot of guys that are the real deal, and who can actually write, talk, pitch, and produce a television show and have the entire thing in their heads. And the first time I ever saw anybody do it was Joss Whedon, and the second time I ever saw anybody do it was Damon Lindelof. And
wow.
I'm very much in awe of Damon's talents. And, you know, it's one of the hard-fought battles on that show is that J.J. gets so much credit for it, and J.J. is very much the real deal. But, what that show has become is largely due to Damon. And he doesn't get enough credit for the kind of work that he does.
Very cool. Do you have more or less input in Heroes where it seems like you share show running with Tim Kring versus Lost, where I believe you were a staff writer, among other staff writers?
Well, I wasn't a staff writer. I mean, it's confusing because people don't really follow how things work in a writer's room. We're not all staff. There is kind of a hierarchy, which is determined by the fact that most writers are also producers, and they're just titles at the end of the day.
Okay.
I was a supervising producer over at Lost. My function in the room was to keep things moving in terms of storytelling, and, you know, that's kind of the thing I do. You don't like that? How about this? You don't like that? How about this? Well, suppose we did this. And that'll keep a room going. I do not have showrunner, whatever he said it was that I share with Mr. Kring. I do have a lot of responsibilities that I welcome, particularly on the production side. But that is definitely a show that is handled by an awful lot of people, including the not before mentioned Adam Armas and Kay Foster.
Okay.
Mr. Verheiden, who has just joined us. I think, you know, it goes without saying that Joe Pekaski and Aaron Colite are going to have a big fan when it goes on. And Jesse Alexander, actually,
not so
quite
much.
A bit. No, we're not going to say not so much this time. This time we're going to give credit where credit's due. Jesse's a genius.
Yeah, I look forward to talking to Jesse about the webisodes this summer.
Well, good luck with that.
Exactly.
You know, just getting Jesse on the phone is a trauma.
Well, I know, but that's hopeful that we will talk. Or if not, Joe and Aaron and I will speak before the end of this current arc.
That would be fantastic.
No, I definitely want to do that. So that's good. I know we're about halfway done, almost halfway done. Is it 11 or 13 for the arc?
It's 13.
Okay, there you go.
And I am writing the last one. I've actually written it, and it's been shot. So
that's cool. Do you want to specify what areas of production you like work in, or you know?
All of them. We all do. I mean,
okay.
We start from the very beginning. You start with, as a writer, you go into your concept meeting, which is where you sit down with the other executive producers and your director, and you talk about sort of the big picture of the whole thing. Then in your concept meeting, you spend a lot more time getting into the specifics of what goes on in the script. Eventually, you're building to going to your production meeting, where all the heads of the various departments talk about the responsibilities. They read the script aloud in terms of what each department is going to need, so that when you write, there's a gun on the table. That the prop department then has to make sure that there's a gun. When the gun goes off, the special effects department has to understand how that's going to happen. The gun hits one of your actors and there's a blood splatter. That's a different department. And then, you know, on top of everything else, what people don't realize is there's a wardrobe department. And the wardrobe department isn't just responsible for having, you know, the shirt on the actor. You're going to do that 3, 4, 5, 6 times. That means they're going to have 3, 4, 5, 6 of the same shirt. It's that kind of incredible detail that you go over, and then absolutely there's casting, and during production itself, you're then on the set and you're making sure that the script is being interpreted properly. There's a bunch of different meetings that go on after that. You know, one of the most important ones is the tone meeting, where you sit with the director and the other executive producers, and you literally go through every scene and talk about what the tone of the scene is going to be, what the actors are doing, you know, and what you're trying to achieve out of that, what the writer sees, what the director sees, and you know, so that when you're standing on the floor, which is production talk for being shooting the scene, you're not having an argument over whether or not it's a comedy or a drama or whether or not Siler should be smiling or not smiling. So that kind of thing is you're sort of prepping in advance. And then you have to remember, you know, you have to make your day. I mean, you have a limited amount of time to shoot X number of pages. And so it's a combination of how complicated the camera moves are going to be, which has an enormous amount to do with how much time you chew through, and secondarily, how that, and equally important, what those performances are going to be. And that's what the director has to keep in their head, and hopefully having a writer on set who's also producing, you're continually looking at what's important, what the director ought to be getting, and how those performances are playing out per your script. And then there's a whole next set, which is the post-production, which is editing and music and color timing and getting it ready in order to go on the air. And oftentimes from where you started in the room when you first pitched the story and you were making an outline and to that day that it airs, it looks very much like what you have in mind. And sometimes it's a whole brand new box of chocolates and hopefully it's better than what you started out with. Wow, look at that. I just took you through all kinds of jobs.
Yeah, that was very good. No, honestly. Well done. Mark DeChimp.
Ah, Mark DeChimp.
Hey, guys. Jeff, before I start, I just wanted to show the love for Fallen Sun. You and each artist just nailed that mini. It really is a beautiful send-off for the character, and it really helps cement my personal sentiment that Steve's death should be permanent, in addition to Brubaker's excellent work, obviously. So here are his questions. First, I'm really enjoying Hulk. It's a fun read. Major props on putting Chris Jeruso's Blue Hulk in the Who is Hulk page in issue 6, also co-written by...
Well, it's not co-written. Audie writes it, and Audie was the one that created the Blue Hulk. So, you know, I give credit to where that's going. It would not be Chris's Blue Hulk. But Chris's depiction of him, who's sort of a Hulk-like smurf, is pretty awesome. And to give credit where credit's due, it was Nate Crosby, who I refer to often as Bill Cosby or Norm Crosby, or his name is actually Cosby, but I'm going to let him just be whatever it is, and Nate and Nellie and Nessie and all the other names that I refer to him. He does those previously on Hulk pages. And then we have huge arguments because he's continually trying to push way past the barriers of good taste. But it was his idea to stick Blue Hulk in there, and I'm always happy to see the work of my beautiful daughter in anything I do.
Excellent. What's it like working with Joe Madd? Honestly, he sold me on Ultimates 3. I'm only 23, so when I wax nostalgic about X-Men, his art always comes to mind.
It's great. He's busy as hell. That's the thing you have to get used to. He is running in the same kind of way I am running an episode of a gigantic television series. He is running a massively complicated video game company. So how he found the time in order to draw any of it is sort of awesome to me. And at the end of the day, if you include all the covers, he did about almost 200 pages. Which he had not done in 5, 6, 8 years. I don't know what he had done.
Wow.
And he just jumped right back on it, and his stuff looked amazing to me. And, you know, both introducing him to a new generation at the same time, reintroducing him to some people that, you know, had seen his stuff, and whether or not they were X-Men fans or Battle Chaser fans, it's just a gigantic talent. And like I said, you know, that'll be a trade that sticks around for a long, long time.
Who designed the Ultimate Hawkeye costume? Was it you or Joe? He absolutely loved it.
Joe. Joe had an earlier version of it, which I nixed because it just smelled way too much like Grifter. And because we were changing him over to somebody that could use weapons, I wanted to be careful about that. And he tweaked it here and there, and that's what goes on. Actually, I think if you look at some of the original sketches, I think that were in Wizard Magazine, the original version is there. And as time went by, I think he really nailed it. you know, these things grow. It's a growing process.
Look who's next. It's Gail Simone, everybody. It really is.
Is she coming in?
No, she's like, she's asking a question here on the
board. Okay, all right.
I love the Charles Maxey series. You and Tim did, as you already know.
Yeah, all four of us.
Me too, though. And
I understand.
And
Simone, Bendis.
That's true, I guess. Yeah, there's five.
And then somebody that I haven't met yet. Rick Pease in the morning, I think.
Disco Duck. You've been spending a lot of time with the icons. Is it inconceivable to see you do another book featuring B and C list characters?
I don't think it's inconceivable. I like using those characters in the icons. If you look at anywhere from Superman, Batman, where people like Jonah Hex and Commandy were running around, over to right now on the Hulk, you know, I'm walking around with, you know, I wouldn't say it's the B characters as She-Hulk and Submariner, but, you know, those guys are dropping by, and Doc Samson, and,
sure.
You know, my cast is pretty... pretty eclectic as it goes. I was really lucky that I got to play with Iron Man at sort of the height of the Iron Man stuff. But he just felt like he was the right guy, right, Doc?
Oh, yeah. But as you make fun of Nightwing fans, is there a B or C list Nightwing level character favorite of yours?
Do they still publish Nightwing?
Yes, they do.
That's kind of amazing to me. They publish a Nightwing and a Robin comic. Those are the things that I love.
That's where some of DC management and you apparently agree.
It's like if they put out a Bucky comic, I think we'd all sit around and go, why?
But you like, am I correct in assuming you like what Pack is doing with the Incredible Herc?
I do.
I mean, it's cool. It's a cool idea. I mean,
But Hercules was always a character that because of Thor, you could make an argument that he had a book. But, you know, in the same kind of way, to answer the question, I would not write a Moon Knight miniseries, but I love the fact that Moon Knight is now running around in the Hulk.
Sure, with Sentry, which is cool.
Yes, exactly.
And Ms. Marvel. Okay, but all right. I had another one in mind, but I guess it went away.
It went away.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's like when I mean, Bendis does it better than anybody else, and, you know, I mean, we all cared about Spider-Woman, and he made you care about Spider-Woman.
Right.
By the same token, you know, that one little cameo of Brother Voodoo, I just thought was awesome. So much so that, you know, we'll see whether or not that pops up somewhere over in my book.
Okay, very cool. Or I was going to say, remember now, a Brubaker infraction on Iron Fist. Look what they did with that C-list character. They made me give a shit about him again.
Yeah, I come from that time period. Unlike some of those other characters that we're talking about, Power Man on Iron Fist, for me, was a real book.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, you know, going all the way back, I would think we'd make a terrific television series. And I know that, you know, they'll probably looking at it and going, well, we should do these as features, but... At a certain point, you got to jump and decide you're going to be in the television business. But the idea of a kung fu guy and a guy who's got impenetrable skin, one who has money and one who doesn't, and they're heroes for hire, it's a television series.
Yeah,
Heroes for Hire. What a great name.
Yeah, yeah. Dan C. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for taking the time to answer all these insane questions.
Well, thanks, Dan. I appreciate that.
Here's his two. considering how much people love the Miller-Hitch run, when taking on the task of writing Ultimates 3, did you feel like you were walking into a shitstorm no matter what wound up on the page? I personally like the story, but there was obviously lots of chatter about it on the interwebs.
I never gave it one moment's thought, and the only thought I gave was that they were Mark's characters. And so I spent a lot of time talking to Mark about where things were going, which is the thing that cracks me up, where people say, you know, I don't understand the characters at all. All of that was talk with Mark, and they were the direction in which we were going. And I wrote to him specifically and said, does any of this stink? Let me know. And I think the only thing that kind of caught him off guard was that he does like the fact that, we've talked about this, that Thor did not speak with the these and thous.
Right.
Because the kids, they don't understand that. I inherited it
from Straczynski.
So and I tried to explain it. And you know, I think that when we talk about what happens at the end of Ultimatum, there may be a way to go back to what Mark was doing. I do think it's a valid point, and maybe there is something there. But everybody else to me has the same trajectory that I really like.
Okay. Are there any other characters you have considered writing color books for? Punisher, Iron Man. It's funny he asks Moon Knight, et cetera. We just got the answer for that. That would be no.
Yes, there are, yes. And we'll, you know, as soon as we finish White, we'll announce what the next one's going to be.
Cool. August Miller. Hey, Jeff, I just finished rewatching Saving Private Ryan, and damn, I hope you have plenty of World War II action set up in Captain White.
Not only do I, there's actually a bit that's in the first issue that I specifically told Tim, you need to go look at the movie again, and because it's not the scene, but there's a vision that I had of this. There's a moment in Saving Private Ryan where the building has completely collapsed, and there's a family on the second floor that's basically standing in their kitchen trying to figure out what to do. And there's basically 4 feet of floor, and they're terrified. And, you know, I just said, I think that's a very cool image to start with. So we'll certainly see that.
Very cool. Where am I? There I am. Oh, do you consider yourself a fan of war comic books? Would you write any? That's a good question. Like,
not so much. No.
Okay.
I think people know. I like guys running around in costumes. This is as close to a war comic as I'll do, but not as close to Jesse Alexander's one-shot, Sergeant Fury and the Howling Commandos, Shotgun Opera.
Very cool.
Which I've now seen artwork done by Jean-Paul Leon, which is astonishing.
Of course it is. It's Jean-Paul Leon. That guy's amazing.
It's so amazing. And what's terrific about it is how he interpreted Jesse's script, since it was Jesse's first comic. And he managed to get all that stuff on the page. You know, one of the things that you wind up doing when you first write a comic, and I can certainly speak to it, is that you forget exactly how much drawing is involved. So, you know, suddenly you've got 93 panels and 67 things that happen in each of the panels, and you have to get to that place where you can suddenly learn how to do that thing that Scott McCloud talks about that I never understand, which is the, you know, where you have to dump out the middle piece so that when the reader's reading it, they get, oh, I see, between that and that. You know, if you cut a film the way a comic book is done, people wouldn't know what is going on. But you have movement. So, in a comic, you have somebody standing in front of a door, and then in the next panel, the guy's inside the room. You might need a shot of a hand on a doorknob. But in a movie, you'd need to see somebody walk through.
Sure.
Anyway, what Jean-Paul was able to do with Jesse's script was to take all that stuff and make it into something that's pretty astonishing.
Excellent, man. No, I'm really looking forward to that. Dave0923. Dear Mr. Loeb, I'm going to...
Now, when Dave figured that out, what do you think all those numbers mean?
I'm assuming it's high school locker combo.
I like that. Okay, we'll go with that.
Or his birthday.
0923, that's good. Okay.
There you go. I'm going to geek out a little bit and say you're absolutely one of my favorite writers who's ever worked in the medium.
There you go.
You've done everything from making me cry after Sam's story, which was absolutely beautiful, making me fall in love with Lana Lang and Gwen Stacy, and feel a sense of dread when Harvey Dent fell from grace. But now that I got all that on my system, here, however, this is a question I've wanted to ask you for literally years. If you and Sale ever, yep.
Okay, all right.
If you and Sale ever return to DC Comics, would you guys ever do a Flash story, a la For All Seasons and Long Halloween, after seeing Tim's amazing work on larger-than-life characters like Superman, especially with those amazing speed sequences and your ability to write great detective stories? I think it absolutely would be awesome to read, especially with Barry Allen as the main character.
No. I can tell you that Tim has no love for the Flash at all.
Really?
Tim has very specific tastes. So if I told him the Flash, he would look at me and go, "Who?"
Okay.
Also, we have to remember he's a Marvel guy at the end of the day. So you're much more likely to talk to him about Thor or Cap or any of the other Avengers than you're ever going to be able to get to any of the Justice League members.
Okay.
I will tell you that there is a sequence that's in a New Frontier. There's kind of a high-angle shot of the city, and there's just a blur sort of going through, like almost like a mouse going through a maze, that Darwin drew, and I thought it was one of the best captures of how the Flash works that I've ever seen. And I, you know, I did my one Flash story. I did Ed McGuinness and I did one of those Julie Schwartz cover things.
Oh yeah.
And again, one of those comics that I continually forget I actually did. And every now and then, someone will bring it to me in a con, and I'll go, "Oh yeah, I did this one."
That was the one based on that great Infantino cover where the Flash is saying, "Stop! You got to buy
right.
this, or I'll die."
Exactly.
Very cool.
And I had to come up with a really stupid answer to have to do that.
those covers in particular, those Flash covers, really were amazing back
yeah,
then.
Absolutely.
This one I ask as a writer. This question: I'm fairly young, but I have an overwhelming desire to write comics and to put something out there into the world. And over the past few years, I've made a lot of great friends who can draw with amazing skill. And I'm going to self-publish my own books at the beginning of 2009. Is this a good idea for someone who really wants to write comics? I know the risk, but I just want to get an opinion from a grand poobah of comics like yourself.
Not only do I think it is actually the only way to get in. And, you know, Bendis speaks to this often, and I'm surprised if he's on that board that he's not asking Bendis. But the only other thing that I would suggest is rather than, you know, when you say self-published, that sounds like you're going to spend a lot of money. What you may want to do is to put it on the web and not actually publish, but give it at a place that somebody can go and look at it there or download it off of there. The cost of publishing in paper is becoming more and more prohibitive, particularly for a young person. And, you know, while it's okay to put those things together out at Kinko's, you really want it to have a professional look. And your color looks better on a computer screen than it does when it prints. So, you know, I would take the time in order to learn how to set up a website and or get somebody who does. And then tell people if they want to go see Maxi-Man, he's at Maxi-Man.com. And you put out stories that way. But it is absolutely imperative that when you talk to an editor at a comic book convention and you're going to try to convince them to hire you to work on anything, it is much easier for them to be able to make the decision based on the fact that you already had a published story. And independent comics is the way to go there. See, that's where Mr. Kirkman and I disagree. Mr. Kirkman thinks that the way to go is for you to start in the land of children's comics and then move over to something independent. My opinion is you start in something independent or small and then you move up into the icons and have a nice day.
There you go. Mark for myself.
Mark for yourself.
Finally, I get to post another question thread. I'm always a dollar late and a day short. I'm inquiring from the mean streets of Vermont, where men are men. Okay, fine. As a huge Veronica Mars fan, I geeked out when I saw Francis Weevil Capra on Heroes.
Yes.
Please tell me he will have a major role this season and perhaps beyond, whether or not there's a possibility of any other Veronica Mars reunions.
I can never speak to whether or not there's going to be Veronica Mars reunions. It's always the best actor for the part. I believe we saw Mr. Capra's head get cut off, so
yes.
Not sure how much more we're going to be seeing a hit.
That's all, folks. Out of your personal catalog of works, which singular story would you cite as the most proud of? We've discussed this, sir. We will move on. And in the course, of course, as November inches closer, we must roll up our sleeves and get into politics. So don't pull back or give the PC answer. We really want to know, Dark Knight or Iron Man, which was the better film and why?
I'm not being PC. They were two different films. I thought, as a pure superhero film, Iron Man was the better movie. It was a lot more fun, and it certainly showed what a hero could be. As a film that didn't necessarily have to be a superhero movie, Batman is the better film. For me, Dark Knight was a cop movie who was dealing with a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
He happened to be dressed up in a bat costume, but the rest of it is a very straight-ahead, really, really interesting exploration of the evil in us all. Two completely different experiences. I like them both.
Very cool. I did, too. Let's see. Also, he was just wondering if you wanted to share any other great or horrid films you've seen this year so far.
Nothing really comes to mind. I can't tell you that we all took off from work one day and Jess Alexander and Aaron Collite and Joe Pekaski and I went to go see Red Belt.
That's hilarious. I just finally saw it myself. Go ahead.
David Mamet. There's 2 hours of my life I'll never get back.
Interesting. I liked it.
So did Jesse. The other three of us sat there with our heads scratched going, really?
I would have liked a little more of the screw over explained. But outside of that, I think it was like a smarter martial arts film, but martial arts films aren't necessarily always smart.
So. Yeah, you know, it's as Kevin Feige said to me, who's the president of Marvel Films, as he said to me when we walked out of the Ang Lee Hulk, and I give him credit for this line, which is, sometimes I like a little more pop with my corn.
There you go. What about, what'd you think of this year's Hulk?
I liked it a lot. I thought Louis did a great job.
Me too, man.
And I particularly thought that the scenes that were taken from Hulk Ray were awfully cool.
There you go. Let's see, Indiana Jones?
I did not see.
Okay.
I look forward to seeing it on DVD or whenever the hell else it's on.
Okay, how about Hellboy?
I liked Hellboy. I saw Hellboy at the premiere. I liked it quite a bit.
Okay. I'm trying to think of any other, I think those were all the superhero-ish.
No, there were six of them, to my memory. I count
Speed
one.
Speed Racer, of course.
I don't count Speed Racer.
Okay.
I liked some of Wanted. I really wanted Mark's vision of it. I thought that was so cool.
I liked Wanted.
I did not understand why, spoiler folks, why Angelina Jolie died. It doesn't make any sense to me at all. And obviously is not dead, because you throw her in the milk bath and she comes back again. But I really thought that the moment that he had trained for was, as the bullet came all over around the room, was that he was going to be able to stop that bullet. And then the two of them going after the bad guy is a much more interesting story to me than what happened. But meanwhile, $200 million later, and I don't have a movie this summer, so, you know. So it was Hulk, Iron Man, Dark Knight, Hellboy, Wanted, and there was one more that I don't remember. What was the last one to come out? There was one that came out during the very end of the summer.
After Batman.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to kick ourselves.
Yeah, I'm blanking. I hate to say it. Oh, well, there was the Star Wars Clone Wars movie.
No.
Okay.
But thanks for sharing.
Well, we try.
What kind of an answer is that? I'm talking about superhero movies. Star Wars, Clone Wars.
Well, I'm just trying to think of, like, movies that fanboys were getting. That's why I threw in Indiana Jones, obviously.
Okay.
But that's fine.
Back out again.
No worries.
I wish I could remember what the other one was. There were six. I know there were six because I pitched that about 12 times.
Yeah, I can't remember, man.
Okay.
Okay, and then we move on to, got to get past Christian Bale here, August Miller.
We're back with August Miller.
Yeah, he didn't understand three questions per. Well, he put all of his questions all over the place. I'm moving on. August Miller, we've addressed this question. Sorry.
Okay.
Wig, who is a first-timer? First-time caller.
Okay.
Your writing seems to have big over-the-top moments. Have there been any ideas that were too big and over-the-top at either DC and Marvel?
No. I don't. I mean, I think the only thing you can do is just make sure that, A, you try to stay true to the character, and B, just the real reality of, you know, can the artist actually draw what it is that's in your head? And fortunately, when you're working with somebody like Ed McGuinness, I don't think there is a top.
Okay, there you go. Here's a good one that you'll like. Which sidekick has had a better superhero career, Jimmy Olsen or Rick Jones?
Well, Jimmy has. I mean, he's been around forever, and I think Jimmy's gotten laid.
Indeed.
Yeah, I kind of like the fact that Rick is sort of the guy that gets thrown down the well all the time. But that's nowhere near the cachet,
right,
that Jimmy has.
You know, James Robinson this week did a Jimmy Olsen story, and I felt like it harkened back to the good old days. and that it was a decent Jimmy Olsen story. It's been a long time since we've seen a decent Jimmy Olsen story.
Well, that's one of the things that James does really well is that, you know, like Jeff Johns, this sort of goes back to the spirit of the original character and makes them come out pretty cool. So I respect that in the man.
There you go. If you can trade one Marvel character to DC and one DC character to Marvel, who would they be and why? Anybody in the wrong universe?
Well, I'd take Batman.
That's what I figured.
And I give them, you know, Speedball.
Nice.
I mean, do I have to be nice to them? I don't understand. He didn't ask me whether or not they have to be of equal caliber.
All right. Is there a DC character that's stuck in the Marvel universe? The way some Marvel people feel Batman is? In the DC?
Oh, I see. Is there a DC character that's in the...
Yeah.
Is there a Marvel Universe character in the DC Universe?
No, I mean...
No, the other way around. Is there a DC character in the Marvel Universe?
Yeah.
That you're asking.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll take a lot of flack for this, but I think you could absolutely write Cap to be a DC hero.
I agree with that.
That's the one that comes immediately
to mind.
And I think you know, the similarities between Iron Man and Green Lantern are pretty... clear as well.
That's fair too.
You know, I think Tony is much darker, but you know, Tony and Bruce Wayne have an awful lot of similarities too. So
sure.
And
I think of that Byrne Cap Batman team up that he did back in the 80s or 90s.
Boy, you stuck in a groove I would never get into.
Oh, I like that. That was fun.
Yeah, really?
Okay. I thought so. Yeah, okay. It kind of had a Dick Sprang look to it. It made me laugh.
Brag, look to it. No, okay. Meanwhile, the kids at home are going, who?
That's the first page of the DC Vault is this Dick Sprang look at the Batcave.
Oh, yeah. No, that's pretty funny.
That's kind of like that Jim Lee thing. Didn't you guys do that in Hush?
Not kind of like.
Was it in Hush?
No, we did it in Hush first.
Okay.
And then Jim took that and decided to make it an 8-page fold-out dreidel thing.
That's right.
But all of it comes from
dreidel thing.
All that comes from the Sprang overshot,
sure.
Kind of thing. But it was Jim who came up with the idea in Hush that the Batmobiles would be kept on a Ferris wheel so that you could just, you know, drop them down, which is such a James Bond cool idea, and I'm surprised I've never seen it in anything.
You're right, that is cool. This is Rod Nunley.
Hello, Rod.
I know that you and Matt Wiseman co-authored the script for Commando.
Yes, we did.
I am dying to know if it was you or him that wrote my favorite line from the film. Remember when I told you I was going to kill you last? I lied.
It's one of those things where I don't actually remember.
Okay.
You know, things happen in the ether of when you're writing that you don't remember who exactly wrote what.
And forgive me for thinking that was a Rainier Wolfcastle line and not a real Schwarzenegger line. So nice going.
Come on. A Rainier Wolfcastle. I can tell you a little known fact, which is it was Adam Armas who first coined the phrase, save the trailer, save the world.
Ah, okay. Very cool. Having yourself written a highly regarded Superman story, Superman for All Seasons, I'm wondering if you have any insight as to why many writers struggle with writing good Superman stories. I was just talking to Gail about this. So I would love to hear what you have to say about this.
I don't know. I hear a lot of theories about it. I love writing the character. I loved writing him on Smallville. I think at the end of the day, you're writing Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And if you understand how to write Clark, you understand how to write Superman. The secret of that character is the heart. Once he becomes, a big fighting power machine guy that spouts a bunch of crap, and you're lost. He's a Kansas farm boy who, you know, grew up one day and found out he was the greatest hero that ever lived. Batman works through fear. Superman works through inspiration. But he will never look at you and say, hey, do it my way. He just shows you a way of doing it, and you get inspired to do it.
If
you have a real problem, just take a look at Superman the movie, and I'll explain it all to you.
Very good. You only get one. This is a scenario that he's come up with. You only get to write one more story for DC Comics and one more for Marvel. Which book or character do you write?
Actually, that's not a bad question. I only get one more story?
Yeah.
Well, it'd be really tough. My guess is it probably would be a Superman story, because Batman stories work much better when they're longer. And I think it's easier. Both of them would be tearjerkers. So the Superman story is much easier to do. And over in... It would largely... I'm surprised I didn't say this before. It would largely depend on who's drawing them, because that would make a big difference. You know, if I was doing a Jim Lee Wolverine story, I think we'd have an awful lot of fun doing that. I'm having so much fun writing the Hulk right now, it would probably be a Hulk story. But my guess is if you asked me 6 months from now, I would go, wait, are you kidding me? But that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Okay. Former Batman, who is a newbie, and says, this is my first post here at Jinx World.
Welcome aboard.
I decided to register here, as well as subscribe to Word Balloon on iTunes, after listening to the Bendis tapes back to school edition over the last week or so. Now on to you.
Now you're listening to the Loeb Report.
Exactly.
Good for you, young man.
Jeff, you've been one of my favorite comic book writers since I got back into comics about 8 years ago.
You've been one of my favorite readers, so let's see what we can do for you.
You're one of the few writers whose name on a project will get me to buy it without question, and I'm eagerly anticipating Cap White. My question, though, pertains to DC more than Marvel. After you and the inimitable Tim Sale did the excellent Superman for All Seasons and the downright brilliant Long Halloween and Dark Victory, were there any discussions of the two of you working on any of the other DC icons?
Nope.
Okay. He was specific.
Not because it wasn't something that we weren't asked to do, Tim had no interest in it whatsoever.
There you go. Okay, Sean Juergens. John and Jeff, thanks for both of you us for taking the time to do this. He loves the show, and he's been reading your work for many years, and you've been a hero to me for a long time. While I dream about getting a chance of sitting down and picking your brain, I know it'll never happen, so I'll just settle for these two.
You never know. You know, the world is an incredible place. My car could break down in front of your house.
There you go.
And I need a lift, and suddenly I'm talking to you.
What are your reasons for choosing the way the characters in Hulk are portrayed? Maria Hill, She-Hulk, or even Hulk? He kind of feels like a more brutal Mr. Fixit, he says.
Oh, he's way beyond. Mr. Fixit is a hood.
Yeah.
The guy actually knows what's going on. My choice of portrayals, does that mean that he doesn't think that they sound like all the other characters? Because, you know, She-Hulk. Who's the other guy?
Maria Hill.
I do have fun with Maria, I have to say. The fun of Maria in my book is she's the reader.
Okay.
She's the one who's continually going, wait, what?
Sure.
And that's something I really enjoy.
Okay.
I get to use her as the voice of the person who's continually trying to catch up with the story rather than driving the story.
Okay.
I don't know, a lot of other people use her that way.
Now I'll see if you understand what he means by this, but this is all he says. How do you go about deciding how you're going to pace a book? For example, Ultimates 3, Wolverine, the Marvel Color books, Batman books, Superman books, are they paced in different ways for you?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I would say the first thing I take into consideration is the artist.
Okay.
Some artists can handle a much slower pace, Tim Sale. And so you really want to take the quiet moments and you want to spend three pages of Captain America standing out in front of a tent. If I was doing that same scene with Ed McGuinness, Ed, you know, Cap would have handed Bucky the costume, and on the next page, he would have been standing there in costume.
Okay.
It's just a different way of going about stuff. If you take a look at any of the Tim Sale Batman stories, and you compare them to when I worked with Jim, they're paced differently. Jim's much faster. Hang on one second.
Sure.
Okay.
As I said, we're almost done. We got just a couple left. Drake Dangers.
Drake Danger.
Drake with a D.
Break.
Okay.
Drake.
Yes, not Great Danger.
Which is it?
It's Drake. It's the alliteration Drake Dangers.
Okay, that's what I said.
Oh, okay, they said Great Dangers, but I don't know.
Well, why would I say that?
I don't know. When writing for heroes, how do you choose what sort of superpower to come out with next? Does the brain trust think, oh, I want to bring in a speedster, let's work them into the story, or do you come up with the story first and then find the best fit powers for those?
The second is true.
Okay. That's cool. You've done two Batman stories, three if you count one in Rome, and two Hulk stories. Forgive me if I've missed any others. Are there any other characters you'd like to revisit and tell another story with them?
Huh?
That's what he says.
I've written lots of Batman stories.
There you go.
I mean, you know, we did all that. There's the three. I don't understand the question. Are there more stories that I want to tell with those characters? Yes.
Okay.
I've certainly told a lot more than two Hulk stories.
Yeah, I'm
very
right.
Confused.
Yeah, there's, well, I mean, Long Halloween and Dark Victory and When in Rome and Hush.
And three Halloween specials.
There you go, yes.
That came before that are all collected in Haunted Night. And then, 25 issues of Superman Batman.
Very true.
So,
all right, here's a better one. What's your favorite comedy movie? Mine currently are 40-year-old version of Shaun of the Dead.
Okay, well, you're talking about...
Yeah.
Classic, it would probably be Duck Soup.
There you go.
The Marx Brothers. But as anyone will tell you, I am currently obsessed with Talladega Nights. I have watched it about 30 times. And last night, the last 20 minutes was on again, and I just couldn't have been happier. And when I told somebody that today, they said, you have to stop watching this movie. It's really bad for you. But I don't know what it is. It just makes me laugh and laugh and laugh.
I wasn't watching a comedy last night, but what kept me up was I finally saw The Lookout, that Scott Frank movie. Damn, that's good.
I don't know this movie.
It's the kid from Third Rock in the Sun, Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Okay.
And he is a janitor who was a high school hockey star and got hit in the head with a puck, and it caused massive short-term memory damage. So he is, like, functional, but, really has memory problems, so he can only be a janitor and stuff, and he gets sucked into a bank robbery. And it's really, really good.
Is Milo in it?
I did not see Milo in it, no.
Okay, because Milo is in some bank robbery that goes awry movie that hadn't come out yet. So
no.
I like Scott Frank quite a bit, so I'm sure it was interesting. I've never heard of this film. And then at first I thought you were going to give me French, whatever his name was, that was also on Third Rock, who's in one of the worst movies ever made. That thing where it's where...
With Ben Stiller's wife? With Bridget Wilson?
It's not Ben Stiller's wife. It's...
no, that's not his wife. That's right.
The guy that's...
Madison.
Sampras.
Oh, that's
it's
right.
It's Pete Sampras.
Yeah, it's Pete Sampras's wife. That's right.
It's like Love Stinks or something like that.
Yes, yes.
And it really is. This movie sucks is a better title for it.
It's too... He's
been
in... Yeah, he's
Hold
been...
Hold on one sec. Hang on.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, he's been in some really bad clunkers. I mean, it's too bad because I do think he has been very funny as well.
Stewart. French
Stewart, yes.
Of course, it sounds like one of the 28 flavors.
yeah, it's not going to be one of the color books, isn't it?
yeah, exactly.
It's going to be Batroc French Stewart.
I love that. But anyway, do you know that story? Which is Pete Sampras is watching that movie, sees her, and decides this is the girl that I'm going to marry, and hunts her down, finally gets a date with her, and marries her.
Wow. Well.
And what's amazing about it is she's a horrible person in the movie. So what that rot, I'm not quite sure. But nonetheless, if you really want to waste even 5 minutes of your life, Love Stinks.
Yeah, that's bad.
So it's really pretty bad.
No, look at her in Billy Madison instead. She's much cuter in that.
Okay.
All right, let's see.
And retired now, as near as I can tell.
Oh, wow. Oh, you know, that's always sad. That's like Kevin Kline's wife who...
PBK?
Yes.
I think the world's fine. Don't worry about it.
Oh.
And you're just remembering her breast running around in...
Let's be honest,
in
slow motion.
In Ridgemont High, and it was on the other night. And what was amazing about it was I'd forgotten that Judge Reinhold actually plays the cool guy in that movie.
Well, I don't know how cool he is when he's beaten off in the men's room.
Yeah, but it's still, he's the tough guy. He's the guy that everybody in school is like, hey, Brad, hey, what's going on, Brad? And I'm like, it's just rival, dude. He's like the geek.
In the pirate outfit, too.
Yeah.
Hey, Brad. That's true. Well, and he was in Breaking Away. And, of course, the great voiceover for, whatchamacallit, The Wonder Years. I like
him. He's not in Breaking Away. Daniel Stern's in
That's Daniel Stern. I'm an asshole, and he's also the voice of The Wonder Years. Thank you. Man, I'm Man, the movie radar is off today. I apologize.
That was really embarrassing. How many more questions do we have?
Only like three or four.
Okay, let's go.
Okay, StarCraft. What is your opinion of mishandling of characters just to make someone look better, get motivated, i.e. the women in refrigerator scenario, or playing dumb, tossed in a situation that they could clearly win, but of course they don't because they're not the hero that's designed to save the day in that book?
I don't think that that's the way stories are told. I think that may be the way that you're interpreting the story, but the writer did not set out in order to make somebody look dumb or create a scenario that was for some other purpose. They're telling a story. You may not like it, but that's what happened.
Okay. And StarCraft, he addresses your second question, which is about other artists finishing books. We talked
don't
about
like
that earlier. You don't like it. Once he left Superman Batman, the title floundered a bit. It was either filled with mediocre arcs or just a few fill-in issues. It's been great since Michael Green took over. And my question is, have you read any of the other stuff in between yours and Green's run? If so, what did you think? Was there anything that stood out for you?
You know, I read Mark's variety and stuff because I like Mark quite a bit. I think that, that book was not designed to be what it is right now, which is that they are now, you and I talked about this earlier, this book is now world's finest.
That
book was not designed to be that. It was designed to be a showcase for top-notch talent in terms of the art, and that they were to be huge, larger-than-life stories. So
yes.
It was, you know, the first was everyone in the universe tried to capture Superman and Batman because President Luthor had turned on them, and ultimately it was the end of Luthor. And it ended with Luthor remembering that, realizing that Clark Kent was Superman. Or it didn't. Did it become the crisis? There'll be a crisis. We changed the line at the very end.
Yes.
And then Supergirl, which was, you know, it was Darkseid and Apocalypse, and it was just huge. And then Carlos and I, you know, changed time, and we, you know, asked, well, if Superman and Batman were raised by supervillains, what would that make the world like?
Mm-hmm.
And then the final arc was sort of tied up everything that Ed and I had done all the way back to the beginning of Superman with Emperor Joker and, you know, introducing the Maximums. Here come the Maximums. Which was great fun, knowing that I was going over to take over the Ultimates anyway. So.
Len Snark.
Ah, Mr. Snark.
Jeff, it's 2 a.m., and you get a phone call from Bendis. He's at a furry orgy and can't bring himself to leave the bathroom due to embarrassment. What do you do? And if you feel uncomfortable answering that question, pretend it's a Tahitian boy band concert.
It's simple. At that hour in the morning, the only person I know that's awake is Mark Millar is coming home from the pub, and what I do is I give Mark the address and I send him to go over there, and the two of them will probably wind up having sex. So that'll be good.
Problem solved. It's Arian, ladies and gentlemen, from
Arian, is this the last question of the day?
There are two
six
left.
More.
No, just two. Just two.
You should
two
three or four. Up. I've already asked nine questions. Go ahead.
Two people. Two minutes.
No, I'm not. This is great. I'm having fun.
Excuse me. And Arian actually was re-answering a question himself, so we're moving on to the final question.
Oh.
So instead, but hey, Arian, thanks for chiming in. Robert McSantos. I'm a big fan of
Mr. McSantos.
I'm a big fan of your bizarre work in stories like Superman, Emperor, Joker, and Superman, Batman with a Vengeance. You brought the character back to the DCU after a 20-year absence. Since Bizarro is my favorite character, I feel very grateful for you doing this.
So basically, he is not his favorite character.
In Bizarro world, yeah, I guess that's
well,
true.
I mean, that's what he said. So he's either a Bizarro guy or not a Bizarro guy. But go ahead.
There you go. I like Batzaro myself.
I love Batzaro.
Very funny. Very, very funny. Recently, Geoff Johns took the version of the character you established and ran with it, using him in such stories as Superman Last Son and Superman Escape from Bizarro World. Like you, he seems to have a genuine affection for Bizarro. Is there something in the water at the Empath Magic Treehouse that give people exceptional taste?
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually a one of the things about the sap that's in the tree itself is this. It's like a honey nectar. In fact, it is from the blood of artists and writers from the 1930s.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. Hang on one second.
So in summation, he wanted to know if you had any thing you'd like to talk about as far as why he's such a great... You could share some thoughts on the character with us since you played such an integral role in making him a DCU mainstay again. That and plus he never gets tired of professional...
Bizarro am worst character in DCU. That's all I can tell you.
All right.
Okay.
Nothing else? That'll do it then. Oh, excuse me. We got Jurassic Alien had two quick ones.
Oh, we were there at the end? That's how we were going to go out? We were going to go out on a Bizarro question?
We could have, but he's
okay. Well, then I would have said this was the worst time I ever had. So, you know, whatever you want me to do.
Do you have time for Jurassic Alien quickly?
Absolutely.
With doing Heroes in Comics, where do you find time to write? We discussed this, actually. You do it early in the morning.
I do.
What do you look for in inspiration in your writing? Do you pull from life, throw in some things you used to love from childhood, certain aspects of movies or books, or is it all those things plus some you would love to talk about?
That pretty much summed it up. I don't know what else there could be. Hallucinogenics, I guess, but I don't like talking about that stuff.
And he says, with Dark Knight having come out again, Long Halloween is a book that has been mentioned again and again by the creators of the film and fans alike. You've said this before, but how does it feel having something written that was used as an inspiration to such a great film?
That was great. I like that very much, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for Christopher Nolan and for David Goyer, who's been very generous at mentioning that stuff when they can.
There you go. We've put a close to the Globe Report, gentlemen and ladies.
Too fantastic. I can only say what I say every time I do one of these things. I cannot wait for Mr. Bendis to complete his next Bendis tape so that I can counter with the Globe Report. Globe Report is a copyrighted program of Smokey Productions
and
Happy Sam Dreidels that we do. If you're looking for Happy Sam Dreidel, be sure to pick one up over at all the fine folks at Word Balloon.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Jeff Loeb. We'll talk to you down the road.
Take good care, and be sure, as I say every time I sign off, to check out the new works coming from very talented young writers, the name of Joe Pekaski and Aaron Colite. Jesse Alexander, soon to be seen in Sergeant Fury and Italian Commandos, Shotgun Opera. And hopefully the next time we talk, we'll be able to talk about the brilliant...
Harlow Wilcox.
Which one?
I was kidding, but it's not Harlow. It's Harlow's grandson, Hanson Work. Well,
I don't even know what you're saying. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to make Jim Lee be good to his word and let a young boy's dream of writing Grifter, why Grifter, I can't even tell you,
yeah.
Harrison Wilcox,
yes.
With any kind of luck, will be a published Wildstorm author the next time we talk.
Good luck, Harrison.
Yeah, absolutely, guys.
And my best to the Heroes crew out there and enjoying the show so far. Keep it up, and we will talk very soon.
Take good care. Bye.
So that wraps up this edition of the Loeb Report. By the way, my pals over at the Stack and their live show that they do in New York, Comic Book Club, featured a great interview with Loeb, Bendis, Matt Fraction, Ed Brubaker, and how about Jeff Katz, the fine screenwriter and former writer of Booster Gold. They were all together for the Comic Book Club, and that's available at YouTube. Now, I'm not going to give you the URL because it's too long to write, but if you just go to YouTube and search for Comic Book Club and either put in Loeb or Bendis, I'm sure it's going to pop up. Very, very funny thing that they did at the beginning of November. But that'll do it for this edition of the Loeb Tapes and Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress. Once again, Word Balloon is brought to you by Devil May Cry, the anime series. The complete series, volumes 1, 2, and 3 are available now on DVD. To Dante, it's more than just a game. Cursed by his half-monstrous, half-human nature, Dante must spend his life fighting the forces of darkness and demons, big ones, sly ones, crafty ones, and sexy ones. Everyone knows demons come in all shapes and sizes, and somebody's got to send them back to hell. And Dante's all too happy to do it, especially if there's money involved. You can check out some action scene clips and trailers at Funimation.com/DevilMayCry. That's Devil May Cry, the anime series, the complete series, volumes 1, 2, and 3, available now on DVD from Funimation Entertainment. Don't forget, Word Balloon is all over the internet. Of course, we're at Newsarama.com. You can find us at MyTunes at MySpace.com/WordBalloon, ComicSpace.com/WordBalloon, all the various podcatching sites, Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, If you'd like to write us an iTunes review or a Podcast Alley review, we would certainly appreciate it. Or any of the places that you go to for podcasts, if they have room for reviews for Word Balloon, we appreciate your input. Questions or comments about the show, there's the Word Balloon Forum, which is available at wordballoon.com. You'll also find a nice archive of lots of our past interviews there, well over 175 interviews and running. And also, you can ask a question directly to me if you want via email, john@wordballoon.com. Again, thanks. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, not Smokey. Copyright 2008.